We'll call a meeting to order, and Representative Atkins moved the minutes of the last Thursday's meeting. Are there any additions or corrections? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign, motion prevails. I think, do we have the is technology working? I wanted to have, oh, God, I want to turn my. I wanted to have the students come up first. I don't know how to turn it off. I turned it off once and I couldn't turn it back
on.
I'll
call you. We'll see if it's on.
It's off.
Mr. Chairman, don't you owe us something?
No.
In other committees, cookies in here.
We'll have the students from the university come up first, and we're going to be hearing from them. And I've asked Ms. Novak or maybe Mr. Berg to comment then a little later after we hear from the students on the governor's budget proposals and how it affects the higher education portion of this committee. And as soon as we get things working, which should be shortly, we'll have the student representatives from the University of Minnesota come up. And so I don't know who's going to lead this over there, but are you all coming up, or some of you, or whoever you, four of you, three of you, that's fine. Four, three, four. Okay, why don't you just come on up to the table then up here, the four of you that are going to speak, or the three of you, and we'll get going. And we also have faculty from the university today. I don't believe we have faculty from Crookston or Duluth, which I'm a little disappointed in, but staff will correct that snafu next time. Anyway, welcome to the committee, and introduce yourself for us, and you go ahead after you introduce yourself and make your presentation. And committee members, I think this is very informal. We want to get the opinion of the students, and we'll have Minsky next week, I think. And so if you want to break in anyone anytime for questions for committee members, go ahead. Welcome to the committee, Alex, Marty, Lauren, and Christy, and whoever's going first, go ahead.
Honorable Chair Rivina, members of the committee, I just wanted to begin with what the university means to me.
And you've been begin with your name, though.
Martin, for example.
Sorry. Okay, Martin, thank you.
And I'm a student legislative advocate for the students. So to me, the university is a lot more than just a place where I go to school. It's my community, it's where I live, it's where my friends and mentors are, and most of all, it's a place where I learn. And so much of that is outside of the classroom. I mean, a lot of development that we do is in our class, but so much of it is the programs, such as this one, the Legislative Advocate Program, and such as Fraternity and Sorority Life, so many of these other areas that really require a lot of funding and are becoming more difficult as the economic climate worsens. I can speak from personal experience. My parents spent a lot of time and sacrificed quite a bit to save to help me with my college tuition, and those accounts are down quite a bit, which is going to make it more difficult for me to help work for college, and it's going to really decrease my ability to do many different activities. And, you know, to us it's a lot more than just tuition, and that's one of the main issues, but a lot of it is our quality of education. You know, if we decrease these programs, it's really going to compromise the community and the culture of the university. So we just, you know, it really means a lot to us to make sure that we keep this going, continue to attract the best students, and really make it easier for us to be able to make the commitment to the university.
Okay. That's for Sean, I guess.
Hi, I'm Christy Kramers, and I'm a second-year PhD student in educational policy and administration at the U of M. And I'm also a president of the Graduate Professional Student Assembly, so I represent the 23,000 graduate professional students at the U of M. We're 40% of the student population at the U, and it's really extraordinary the amount of PhD programs that we have. We're the second largest provider in the nation for a public research institution. Berkeley's number one. We're close to second. So we're producing some of the finest graduates in the country. But we're going to lose our edge on how competitive we can be in attracting those students to the U of M. If this decrease happens, it will impact the amount of research we're able to do. As many of you know, for every $1 million that we receive in federal grants, and we receive $675 million from federal funds, for every $1 million of that $675 million, we create 36 to 39 jobs outside of the university. And that's approximately 25,000 jobs a year outside of the university itself. And I'm a first-generation college student. I'm from the St. Cloud area. I'm one of those students that should have never made it this far without the Minnesota Miracle. My parents both grew up on farms. My grandmother was a single mother of 12 children, and my other grandmother only made it through the eighth grade. And so I feel extremely privileged to be where I am, and I want to make sure that future generations, that my own children have these same opportunities. But they won't with the increasing amount of debt we're having to take out to pay for our student loans. For a career such as law school and medicine, our medical school students, on average, and this is just the average figure, graduate with $141,000 of debt. $141,000. And if these trends persist, and $20,033, half of their income will go towards paying back their student loans. Half of their income. So we can no longer rely on those traditional professions that would make a quality life for Minnesotans. And I just want to say, please deeply consider also the research behind why higher education is important. I know one of the proposals of the governor is to increase, and this is more related to MinSU than it is us, but I think it's important to increase online learning to 25% of the courses for the MinSU system by 2015. And I think that's a horrible decision to make because, as one of my students up here mentioned, that the primary way students learn is through their interactions with peers and faculty. And research shows that consistently over and over again. As a teacher and as a student who has been involved in online courses, I can tell you the quality is substantially higher inside the classroom and on campus. Thank you.
Chairman Rukavina and honorable members of the committee, my name is Alex Tenenbaum, and I'm here on behalf of the students at the University of Minnesota, in particular the undergrads. And obviously, with the budget cut, tuition is a major concern for all students. And I think the people that we really got to think about most are the students that are either paying for their tuition or paying for a significant share of their tuition. And I think this is very, very important because higher tuition means that students are piling up more debt, but more importantly, they're working long hours in college at jobs that aren't necessarily really developing those skills that they're going to be using when they become, enter the community or when they start looking for jobs or are working in the corporations here in Minnesota. For instance, one of my very, very good friends, Michael Conway, he's a senior, he's graduating from Moore, Minnesota. He's paying all the school, all the expenses, and he works a lot of hours as a waiter because he makes good money, and he has school and he's working as a waiter and he wants to go to law school. And what he says is, well, Alex, it's hard for me to apply to those internships that would be great for networking and learning those skills when I can't work 10 to 20 hours a week being unpaid because I need all that money to go for tuition, all my work to go for tuition. So that's kind of the first way I think that students that are putting a lot of the bill are affected by higher tuition. The second one, kind of going off that, is leadership opportunities. Minnesota, the University of Minnesota, as Martin already mentioned, has great opportunities for leadership to develop leadership skills and other skills that people will be using. But again, if you're working a lot, you can't participate in those types of programs like you may want to. One of my good friends, Jillian Miller, she's from Buffalo, she's a sophomore. she really wanted to do Welcome Week. It's a week-long program that we have for incoming freshmen. It's a new program, a lot of leadership opportunities and seminars. And she wasn't able to do it because she had to work full-time during the summer. She couldn't take a week off because she had to put the bill, save a lot of money for tuition. So, and that's the second way, just lost leadership and extracurricular programs. And just going right off of that is philanthropy and community service. President Obama's made a very big deal about that, especially for our younger generations, to kind of help out in the community. And again, if you're working a lot, that's going to cut into that philanthropy time. And it seems almost counterintuitive for a public institution to have students working so much to pay to go there that they can't get out into the community. So I think those three ideas, it shortchanges the students, and I think in the long term, it shortchanges the whole community, whether they're going to be community activists, business people, entrepreneurs. We all understand there's budget cuts, and everybody's going to have to work together and make tough decisions, but we really ask the members of this committee in particular, but the whole body, the whole legislature, to really consider what the priorities are and helping the University of Minnesota make a commitment to the students and to the state. Thank you.
Finally.
Terry Covina, honorable members of the committee. My name is Lauren Erickson, and I am also a student legislative advocate for the undergraduates at the University of Minnesota. Today I'm kind of just expanding off what these two gentlemen have just said, but I'm a student coming from out of state. I'm from Illinois, and I've had the opportunity through the University of Minnesota to receive scholarships for my grades coming into the school, which was very fortunate because we do not have reciprocity, and it was my first choice to come to the University of Minnesota over even the schools that they offered in my state because of the amazing
opportunity. Lauren, can you hold on just a second? I
can wait.
You can wait? Okay. Excuse me. Go ahead.
All right. Thank you. So I've just been so fortunate to be having this help throughout my time at the U, and just to be able to know I could continue that for my next year and a half, finishing up my degree in the journalism school. And then also just seeing so many of my friends and classmates' commitment to learning, that even one of my friends from my first year just left last semester because she couldn't pay for school, and she worked full-time for a semester, and she just came back to restart, and she had the opportunity to switch her major because she had the time to think about what she wanted to do, and now she's an English major, and I think that's a great opportunity for someone who can read an entire novel in one afternoon. So it's just great seeing student commitment like myself to their education and to be able to pay for that, and I just hope that in the future maybe someone like her would have the opportunity to be able to finish her 4 years or 3.5 years even, and graduate from the U and then be able to pay back the loans without being able to have to work for a semester. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you all for coming here. And before I get to represent Detmer, I just want to thank you university students. You know, I have to tell you, the previous couple of years, I was a little disappointed that the university students didn't have much of a presence around here, and your peers in the Minsky system kind of had to carry the load for you, some of them even being in the audience today. But now I've been visited by a couple of your co-students at the university, and I've been told you're going to get more active. And did the Board of Regents buy those blazers, by the way, for you? Or were those?
We don't have any money.
But I'm glad you're going to be around, and I hope you really participate in the process, because your absence was a little noticeable the last few years. So with that, Representative Detmer first.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, those were sharp maroon and gold blazers. Regarding the 25% online learning, could you give us a little idea what the courses of studies that maybe that you're currently in that would qualify for the online learning?
Well, I'm...
Go ahead.
I'm not currently in any courses at the TC level that would fit into that model, but I did teach a course that was offered for study abroad students. So half of my class was in Venezuela, half of my class was in Italy, and I think that was a fine use of online system because there's only so many ways to connect with the students while they were abroad. But in my own experience as an undergraduate and as a master's student previously, the one online class that I had in both environments, it just does not compare to the quality of what you experience inside the classroom for a variety of reasons. And I hate to say it, but when you look at the research, and particularly for undergraduates, the retention rates go way down when you have online courses. And we have the University of Phoenix and Capella and other similar types of private entities that do provide that for students who are seeking it. And I think it's important, you know, for students who are in geographic locations where it's inaccessible for them to come to campus to have those opportunities available. But to have it be a strategic priority to have 25% of the courses is out of line.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, just follow up. Any comments from the rest of you regarding online learning?
Yeah, Representative Bettner. I really think that online courses are a great offering for people, like she said, who can't geographically get to class, for people who have to work during the day. But to mandate increasing that, I think, would be terrible. I can speak from personal experience. For example, my freshman year, I had a physics course, and I met a friend in that course who introduced me to tutoring. So I started doing ACT tutoring, spent a year and a half doing college prep. Now I co-coordinate a program with a free college prep for inner-city students and one to teach for America. I had no idea what I wanted to do when I came to the university. If I took that class online, which I probably could have just looking at the slides, I never would have met that person. I still have no idea what I wanted to do with my life. And I have so many friends who have taken online courses, and they just wait until the last day, you know, to do all the work. There's no motivation to get up and go to class. You don't walk around and see the diversity of the campus when you walk to and from class. And so many people, I had a friend last semester who's in the Minsky system, and he dropped all his online courses last semester because he just never had the motivation to get up and do them. He did great in his other courses, but he dropped all of them. I think that mandating them would really track the university.
Yeah. Thank you.
Other members? To the students. Oh, excuse me, Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as a U of M alum, I'm happy to have you guys on board. My short comment on online learning, great supplement for, but not a substitute for regular classes. My question to you guys, the governor apparently is going to propose a tuition cap. President Bruning sat in the same chairs and said that tuition cap would be devastating. You guys have an opinion?
You should. You're college students. Come on.
Yeah,
this is a tough question.
I do.
Go ahead, Alex.
It is a tough question because we actually had Mr. Brunick come speak to us last week, and we were talking about it. And it's very tough because on the one side, as a student, I would love to see that my tuition would never go above 5.5% or whatever the cap is going to be proposed. But on the other hand, I really value that although I'm paying a lot for my education, that it's going to come out and mean a lot to me. And I've had great professors and a lot of services and go on and on. I'm sure the University lobbies will talk about it for you guys, but there's a lot of great programs, and if we're putting a cap and then we're going to be cutting funding, I mean, then we're going to have to cut a lot of programs that mean a lot to people, and we're going to have to get rid of good faculty. So would I be opposed to that? I would say yes, despite the fact that I would love to see tuition stay low, because I think the quality of the university is probably one of the best things that the state has to offer. And I mean, I'm from Wisconsin, that's why I'm here. I'll probably end up settling here. If it wasn't a very good school, I would have gone to Madison. So for me, I think we've got a lot of the university to maintain the standards.
Well,
if I might just say, is that a shared opinion or is that the Tenenbaum position?
That's the Tenenbaum position.
Okay.
For graduate and professional students, it's a mix of a feeling. For a lot of graduate students, they're receiving...
Maybe if I can just break in here, Steve. The graduate students last year took a little bigger bump in tuition. So what are your tuition qualifications?
Well, so distinguishing the graduate students from the professional students, so the med school, law school, vet med, and so on, each college handles their tuition differently. So, for instance, this year it's proposed that the law school will receive 11% increase. And so Elizabeth, who's sitting over there, she's in the law school, she's going to graduate with $90,000 of debt.
Have her contact Representative Atkins after. He's got a scholarship fund.
Oh, great.
Or a job might be better.
Okay, keep going.
And one of her colleagues actually will pay back her last student loan when she receives her first Social Security check. So, looking at the magnitude of what this is going to mean down the road for the professional students is different for a lot of the graduate students who are receiving tuition waivers by being research assistants or teaching assistants with the university. So the impact for graduate students is less than for the professional students who see inflated tuition increases.
If you don't mind me asking, what is your personal situation going as a graduate student in your field?
Last year, I took 5 courses each semester, and I worked 4 jobs. I continued working part-time at St. John's and St. Ben's, where I coordinated their study abroad program. I had a research assistantship, a teaching assistantship, and I was working with student government. So.
And what was your tuition bump last year?
Well, I have a tuition waiver because of my research and teaching assistantship. But still, we have to pay significant student fees. For those of us who are working on our third degrees, you know, for many they have undergraduate and other loans from their master's work, so this is an escalating problem.
Martin, did you want to jump in here?
Sure.
Representative
Thank
Horn.
You. And, Mr. Chair and to the last witness, are you going to be done paying before your first Social Security check?
Well, I was very fortunate in that my parents were able to pay for my undergraduate education. And I actually went to Australia because the tuition rate there was so significantly lower that I was able to do my whole undergrad for $10,000. Yeah, so I was
kids
very
are going to Australia, Mr. Chair.
It's a very unique situation, which isn't shared by many of the 23 students that I represent. So I personally won't have a lot of debt when I graduate, but that is not the norm.
Martin, you wanted to jump in, it seemed like. By the way, that's my middle name and my father's front name. That must be kind of a Slavic name, maybe, then, Trojan Pine.
It's Polish.
Yeah. Martin's a good father.
Kind of the same?
Your testimony's given more weight already.
Yeah. But go ahead.
Well, Representative Atkins, we in the student government passed a resolution stating that we were shooting for a 5.5% increase because what we wanted to do is realize that, you know, it's going to, we have to be pragmatic that there's going to be cuts and that we need to realize that we're not just going to freeze tuition. But we also realize that we can't, especially at this point with economic crisis the way it is, that we can't just shoot up tuition really more than that. I can speak from my roommate who spent the entire last semester all his free time interviewing for jobs. That's all he was doing. He'd get to the second round interview, and then they'd be like, oh, by the way, the position is canceled. I have another friend who had an offer from Best Buy. He thought he knew where in secular he was going when he graduated. He had a good signing bonus. He made a lot of money. Best Buy called him 3 weeks ago, said, by the way, the position is canceled. You don't get a signing bonus. You don't get anything. So all of us now, if you look at the averages on the Office of Higher Education, the last report of 2006 numbers, said that in the public 4-year system, we have an average of $23,400 in debt. This isn't near as much as the graduate students, but consider that with the job market the way it is, with how much harder it is to get loans now, considering how much different loan companies are contracting, and considering how little capital and, you know, collateral we can put up, it becomes really, really difficult. So, I mean, if there's any way possible that we can get that under that 5.5%, it'd be amazing for all of us. If you graduate and you don't have a job, you got to work in a restaurant with a degree, I mean, it's going to be really, really difficult to ask $23,400 in debt and pay living expenses and find time to look for a job.
Lauren, if you don't mind me asking, you know, you said you're in your second year?
Third.
Third year? You're starting your third. So how much debt have you accumulated in 2 years? As a non-resident.
Pardon?
As a non-resident with no reciprocity.
I personally have been very fortunate in both the scholarships I've received from the university and the and outside sources. And so at this point, I try to, I'll take out maybe just a few thousand per year and then try to work to pay it back. I did take the opportunity to be an orientation leader at my school, which did not pay what I needed for what I would normally make at my serving job, and so I'm a little more behind this year, but for the most part, after just a few years out of school, I'll have been able to pay off my debt. But that obviously is not the norm. It's not the norm for many of the students that I work with and that I know. So,
well, that answers your question. Members, and maybe a little later we'll get a more in-depth update. I've asked Ms. Novak and Mr. Berg, but the governor's proposal, as near as we can figure, is just a hair over $150 million cut for the University of Minnesota. So as four students attending there, different programs and different levels, how would you tell us to make sure those cuts are done fairly? If you were President Brunick for a day, or Mr. Hunter on the Board of Regents, or whomever, how would you make up that $150 million? Anybody want to jump at that?
First, I would just like to compliment our president for the amazing work that he has done in developing more scholarship funds, almost $200 million, and ensuring that students who are Pell eligible are receiving completely 100% scholarships from the beginning. And so that is an amazing feat, and I really feel like the institution thus far is doing everything in its power to make it affordable for those who need it most. And so I just really worry about the prestige of our institution, what's going to happen to the worth of my degree when I graduate as the level of prestige drops because we're not able to recruit the best faculty, the best grants, and the best students. And what it's going to do to the state of Minnesota. You know, as a native Minnesotan, I always grew up with pride that Minnesota was known as one of the smart states, you know, and that I could go from having my grandmother only complete the 8th grade to going on for my PhD. And I don't think that's going to be possible for future generations if we continue to use shortcuts to fix long-term solutions. And I see that happening consistently. And I think we need to send a message to the governor that we cannot continue down this path of short-term solutions to a problem that's been going on and on and on, you know, ever since 2002, you know, and earlier before that.
Martin, you want to tell us what you'd do if you were...
Well, I would presume to be President Brunick, you know, because, I mean, I know that just from some conversations we've had with him, that he's doing all he can to try and cut anything imaginable, increase efficiency everywhere, power usage, anything possible. But, I mean, it becomes really difficult because assuming you pass on 5%, 5.5% and increase that tuition, there's still a lot that's left. And then it comes down to, well, do you increase fees? And then that reduces affordability, and Minnesota's already received an F for affordability from a couple of national centers of public policy and thought. And then you consider, oh, well, what about our sports teams or any other subextracurricular involvement? And that really cuts down the community and then the development. And then, well, if you cut classrooms and try to make them online classrooms, you lose out on that community and culture aspect. There really isn't any easy solution. There really isn't anything we can cut without huge ramifications throughout the rest of the university, and you know, just the mentality that it would project onto the university community of, oh, we got cut, we're getting rid of stuff. That just really, really puts a damper on the optimism that I think we're still able to maintain throughout this precious time. And, no, I'd say it would send a really big message if we as a state, Minnesota, said we're going to invest in the long term and ensure that we get the best students from Minnesota, ensure that they stay here, and ensure that the best students from all around the world come here and get educated here, then work here and form the economic foundation for our emergence from this crisis in a couple of years. And if we cut this now, then you know any one of those areas now is really going to hamper our ability to do so in the future. And then it's going to look like, but if we you know, go against the current flow of everyone cutting stuff, I think it's sent an amazing message that Minnesota is committed to education. We're committed to the future. We're committed to the future.
Yes,
thank you, Ted. Mr. Chairman, put you on the spot. Let's say you're governor. Okay.
I like that.
Mr. Chairman, what is the budget of the University of Minnesota? $3
billion? $1.2 billion, I think. Their total budget?
Yeah, their total
annually
budget.
I think they told us $3 billion a year.
$3 billion a year. So knowing that we have to make some cuts as governor, what percentage of the University of Minnesota budget would you think would be fair to cut?
Well, I'm going to duck the question and answer it in a roundabout way.
Now, remember, Christy, you said you were governor for a day, so you can say, I would have never got us in this mess if I was governor.
That's exactly
Mr. Chairman, you're putting words in her mouth.
There was actually a report released earlier this week that talked about other states that are undergoing similar financial crises and how they're protecting higher education. Oregon, Maryland, and one other state that I can't recall offhand. It was in the Chronicle of Higher Education. And what they've done is they've had universities commit to not raising tuition, and they would keep the budget from the previous biennium. So that's one possible solution, is to look to other states to see how they're handling similar crises.
Okay, now you're the lieutenant governor now. Now let's talk to maybe the governor. So, anybody?
As far as what percent, I've never actually sat down and went line by line through the Minnesota budget, so I couldn't give you a definite number on that. But I think it's kind of what Christy's talking about. It's very important to remember the role that Minnesota, the University of Minnesota, plays in Minnesota. We don't have an MIT, Harvard, Boston College, and Boston University within 10 miles of each other. Where Massachusetts, if they cut, I'm just using them as examples, if they cut UMass budget, that's not a big deal. They got the signature programs. So they're going to bring in top talent to that city and to that state. Minnesota is our signature. It's our signature institution. That's where most of our talent is going to be coming in through. That's very important that we keep that as a top quality institution. As far as where the earlier question, where the budget cuts are going to come, if that happened, I have no idea. I'm sure a lot of good faculty are going to have to be let go. It's just the reality of it, which would be a shame to bring in research money, they bring in top quality students, they bring in top of ranking. I don't know, I can think of a lot of professors I'd be upset to let go, but they've published a lot. There'll be other good universities looking for them, and they're going to go if we get $150 million cut, some of them.
Mr. Chairman, just a follow-up. Again, if you're a governor, and I know, I think statewide, we're going to have to make, 19% cuts overall state government. As president of the, or as governor now, what would you do with the University of Minnesota?
Well, hold on a second now. Because Representative Detmer, as I said to this committee and I said in many other committees, I don't think you can make this deficit up just by reduction. So, you know, there could be revenue raised. So that would be an option if you were governor, because, so Martin, the good Pollock, and you can answer this question.
Actually,
go ahead, you answer. Now remember, you're governor, you can propose whatever budget you want.
Well, you know, if I was governor for a day, then I wouldn't have to worry about pledges to, you know, no new taxes. So maybe I'd institute a couple of fees on certain items, and you know, so that it doesn't look like I'm increasing taxes. But I'd say that we would definitely have to look at it from two perspectives. I mean, and all these companies that are cutting right now too, they can't just focus on, oh, we're going to cut everything. you have to look at it from two different sides. And I'd say we have to be open to looking at different ways that we can stimulate our revenue stream, because just considering how all those are coming down, I mean, there's got to be a way to make some of that up. And just to say that we're going to keep the exact same tax structure each year is absolutely ridiculous, considering how much our world's changing each year, how much money comes from different sources. I'd say we should look more into the revenue side. And, you know, if I was governor for a day, I wouldn't have to worry about any ramifications about freaking campaign pledges. So,
Martin, I'm looking for an intern in the office. okay, Representative Mahoney.
Well, Mr. Chair, and for the students, to help them with their governor for the day, I think the state's share of the university's budget is approximately $600 million. And if the governor is making $150 million, a little higher?
Annually.
Pardon?
Annually, yeah.
Annually, yeah. And if the governor is making that kind of a budget cut, I think it's, but anyhow, you're closing in on 25%, if I'm doing the math that you've brought out. That's a significant cut, and it does.
We're looking at 10 or 11% cuts, which is a little higher than proportionally what higher ed is of the state budget. So,
but
we'll get a little brief.
10 or 11%, the rock stars of tomorrow are going to be the scientists that we train today. So what we cut today, we'll pay for dearly and dramatically tomorrow.
Representative Norner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And question to all four of you, I guess. As another way of at least making up the cuts that are being proposed by the governor, do you suppose that there would be support within the university for across-the-board pay freeze? Because I think one of the things that drives the issue in tough times is that everyone still expects their fair share, and others should suffer. So I'm just wondering if that's one way of everybody kind of sharing in some of the pain. And I don't know what that number would mean, but I'm sure there would be significant amounts of money saved either for 1 year or 2 years by
for
doing that.
For all the top administrators, they've already done that. They've already instituted a freeze. And
are you talking about a pay freeze or a hiring freeze?
Well, a pay freeze for those top-tier administrators, and then also a hiring freeze for the entire university system.
And when Brunick came and talked to us, he made it clear that that was the options are on the table for everybody. Like, right now, every single option. I don't know the support because I don't get paid by the university, but I know it's an option right now.
Hmm.
I don't think Representative Norton was referring to work that
No.
Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm curious that one of the things that's going to be before us, or is before us this session, is to set priorities, to fund according to those priorities, and then make cuts and potentially revenue increases if we still can't allocate enough resources to our high priorities. And you've been given a number of scenarios. And I'm curious. I'm a university alumni as well, so Gophers. Chancellor Martin. But, you know, when we look at the proposed figure that's being advocated, I'm curious from the student perspective, how do you see collegiate athletics fitting into this as a part of your experience? I mean, if you have to make priorities, I as an individual would put education first, but I'm a little bit removed from my undergraduate experience now, so I'm curious what you all think about it.
Who wants to jump in?
Go ahead.
Lauren?
Yes. I believe that it's difficult to make a particular call on that, because I'm going to say, as a whole, the university students, the majority, looking at, 28,000 undergrads, they're not going to really have their any difference between whether there's a lot of sports programs or strong athletics, if they're getting what they need in the classroom, which I do believe is a primary focus. But at the same time, that's not to say that it's okay to cut athletics, because that can be such a huge part to a select group of students' experience, maybe how they're paying for school, how they're paying for their education, and it could be the same. It could be their niche in their area on campus, and so I feel like if someone were to cut this program, maybe it would only affect 10 of us, but out of those people, that might be what we like to do on campus. And then what do we have? We only have academics, and the university experience is so much more than that.
My guess, though, is that your, Mr. Chairman, that your advisor doesn't have a multi-million-dollar contract.
Some of the research people they're working for me.
As they should.
Not multi-million. Yes.
I have a comment.
Oh, go ahead, Mark. Yeah.
I'd say that comes back to the community aspect, just because of looking at how well our football and basketball teams have done. It really puts a lift in terms of our community, because I think of the U as it's not job training. I mean, it's just the classroom for job training. But this kind of, it creates an atmosphere. The other thing is having, for example, a stadium on campus. That's something we spend a lot of money to do, and the state spend a lot of money to do as well. But that does is it really helps bring in alumni and other people, and really help stimulate donations too. So it's not just an expense. It helps get alumni re-involved in the university. It helps create an excitement around the university. And a lot of people in high school, maybe really smart people who are looking into certain colleges, might take that into account if there's similar types of statistics when it comes to the ACT or PTA or earnings upon graduation. They see one that has a really great sports program. They can say, wow, you know, that's something that adds to the feel of campus and helps people get more connected on campus.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, I'm thrilled to have a top 20 basketball team, but I'd be more thrilled to have first generation college students leaving with less than $20,000 in debt.
And I'm sure they all agree with you. Representative Oberman.
Thank you, Chair. I'd be curious as to the message that's being sent to particularly undergrads regarding getting through with your degree in 4 years. We had President Brunickson a little back and said the university is making an effort to push folks through because of the cost issues associated with staying longer than 4 years. Can you tell me what the message you got was? And you all look like you're enjoying it, so maybe you're trying to stay for 6 and 7 years. That's fine, but tell me what the message was.
Well, the university has a 4-year guarantee, which is you come in freshman orientation, they stipulate what it is, and pretty much they guarantee that you graduate in 4 years. If you, for instance, you take a night class, if that's the only time that it's offered, things like that. And if you don't graduate in 4 years, they will actually pay for your they'll pay the rest of the way through. Personally, for myself, I've never had a problem in getting into any classes that I need to take. I'm a junior now, so I've filled out a lot of registrations, stuff like that. Most people I know are getting out 4 years. I think I might stay for a fifth, but after taking a minor, it's voluntary. I haven't actually heard of much problem from my friends about having to stay a fifth year because they don't want to. It's usually because they do want to.
Okay. Any other comments on that issue? All righty, Representative Atkins.
Well, that's the very issue I was going to follow up with them. I was going to ask their position. They've been president and governor and ask for their observations as students, because that short of sending my kids down under, it sounds like that the chief thing that they can do to save money is to try to get done in 4 years, and it appears that that's successful among U of M students, so that's good to hear.
Representative Atkins, Australia, is settled by convicts, but I heard they don't take lawyers. So
convicts and legislators.
Yeah.
So I think my kids would be right at all.
Any other questions of the students? I'm glad you're here. Just last for me, how many of you have gotten scholarships of one kind or another from the university? Everyone's a dollar. Poor Alex. And you're the biggest cheerleader out there, too. Gee. Well, okay. And which type?
Well, we receive, it's a little complicated, but for PhD students in my particular department, you receive what's called a 0.25. So they cover half of your tuition, and then the other 0.25 comes from an assistantship that's 10 hours a week. That's for your first year. And then your second year, you're expected to find research assistantships that will cover the rest of it.
Martin, what did you get?
I get a $1,000 a year scholarship that goes directly on my tuition.
do you, was it one of those that we started recently, do you know, or do you know what's
the name? Hey,
Martin! Martin, you're up here at the table. And who's your state representative?
This is my state representative.
And where are you from?
I'm from District 41B.
Well, that doesn't help me. I don't go by numbers. I go by names.
Where are you from?
That must be somewhere in the suburbs. Wilmington. Oh, maybe Lanchester. I'm going to have to tell her that. There I go again, paying for them, too.
Isn't
okay.
That in the Iron Range?
That's right. Well, okay, thank you all very much, and we want to see you around this session as the session progresses.
Keep an eye.
4-year
degree.
That's right. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Now we have the faculty, which we invite up. Four faculty members, who I'm sure if they were governor for a day... Welcome to the committee, and I don't know who wants to start first, but just go ahead, whoever wants to start, and introduce yourself.
I think I get to start.
Go ahead.
Chair Ravina and the committee members, as well as guests of the committee. Probably a lot of you don't know about a quote that a newspaper editor, Horace Greeley, is reported to have said in 1860, is, "I would not live in Minnesota because you can't grow apples there."
Well, can we have your name, though, first?
Oh, sorry, Emily Hoover. I was getting there.
Emily.
Yeah. 100 years of research and extension activities.
Is this yours, Emily?
It is. At the University of Minnesota's Department of Horticultural Sciences has proven him to be wrong. Research within our department ranges from developing new varieties of fruits, vegetables, and landscape plants, as is, I gave you the latest Minnesota Hardy magazine that we put out at the experimentation, to understanding mechanisms that plants have evolved to withstand cold stress. Thank you for the opportunity to meet with your committee. As I said, I'm Emily Hoover, and I'm a faculty member at the University of Minnesota on the Twin Cities campus. I'm also the professor of horticultural science, and as of last week, I'm now the head of that department. And I've been a faculty member since 1982 at the university. As a professor within our newly reformed College of Agriculture, Food, and Natural Resource Sciences, I have a really unique position. Because of where my funding comes through, it's not just from teaching at the University of Minnesota, but I also have money that comes through the Minnesota Extension Service and also the Minnesota Experiment Station. As a faculty member, I have responsibilities for teaching, research, and extension and outreach. So I want to tell you just a little bit about those programs. As a teacher, I taught a breadth of courses at the university, from freshman seminars to graduate seminars. In fact, Lauren was in one of my classes. For example, fall semester, I co-taught a freshman seminar using Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. I don't know how many of you have read it. It's really quite a thought-provoking book. We discussed food from different angles with our freshmen, from what we eat to the United States policy on agricultural systems. We visited community-supported agricultural farms and harvested vegetables with them. We had a farmer come in and share the challenges of being a small local producer of meat and eggs. We really opened students' eyes to the diversity of food produced and eaten, both produced in Minnesota and what comes from other places around the world. My extension and research program focus on commercial fruit production in the state of Minnesota. I work with growers organizations such as the Minnesota Apple Growers Association, the Minnesota Fruit and Vegetable Growers Association, the Minnesota Grape Growers Association. And the goal of our programs are really to reduce the ecological footprint of production practices in fruit crops. I work with growers from many of the communities that you represent. I work with the Jacobsons at Pine Tree Apple Orchard in White Bear Lake. I also work with Eric Luckers and his wife, Sue, at Timberlake Orchards in Fairmont, Minnesota. I work cooperatively with a number of others within the experiment station system to solve production problems that growers encounter. My field research is done at research and outreach centers in Chanhassen, Morris, Crookston, and Grand Rapids, as well as the grower cooperator sites in Alexandria and Annandale and White Bear Lake. But more importantly, I also have the honor of chairing the university's Faculty Consultative Committee, which is the lead committee in faculty governance system at the University of Minnesota. It's one of the reasons that I'm testifying today, not because I really like apples and I can answer any question you want to, but I really, I'm also testifying as well with the three other members of the Faculty Consultative Committee that are testifying here with me. Faculty governance is taken very seriously at the university, and we discuss regularly with the president and the senior vice presidents and provosts issues that are of utmost importance to the university. Yesterday, the vice chair of our faculty consultative committee and I met with the provost for almost an hour to discuss strategies for consultation within university communities and how policies move forward with consultation with faculty, students, and staff.
Faculty and central administrators really do share the shared goal of having a world-class university in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions of Ms. Hoover? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Chair Rukavina and Ms. Hoover. I just wanted to let you know that I represent a vegetable processor, Lakeside Foods, in Plainview, Minnesota.
Uh-huh.
And I met with them recently, and they said, you know, one thing that we benefited from in the past was the research that the University of Minnesota did, especially with the Ag Special and the Experiment and Outreach Station, because they were able to use the research that you did on pesticides and then also on just the varieties of peas and sweet corn. And lately they've said that they feel like there hasn't been that much of a focus on the vegetable side of things. And you said that you work with that. So I just wanted
to ask. I work with fruit crops.
Oh, you work with fruit crops.
Yeah.
But could you at least elaborate a little bit on the research that's being done with vegetables and fruits and why it's important to maintain that?
5 a day. How's that? I don't want to necessarily get into the Ag Special funding because I'm not exactly sure how it all works and whatever. The university has a faculty member at the Waseca Research and Outreach Center who has worked in the past in processing vegetables. When we went through a fairly large budget cut in 2003 at the state specials, those were real budget cuts of about 15% that were not made up with tuition increases, as the Experimentation Extension Service then took real cuts. As a result of those cuts, the funding that comes yearly to faculty members was reduced significantly, and therefore they were, in order to get money for the research programs, had to go to external sources and granting agencies that didn't necessarily put processing vegetables in the upper Midwest as their top priority. So that's what happened.
Well, Ms. Hoover, I want to personally thank you, too, because I want you to know that my cousin, your apples, grow in Embarrass, Minnesota.
Yes. Which one? Frostbite?
I don't know which they are, but he has, and he made his first batch of wine with apples in it, and it's like a little baby in the room that's wrapped up in a little quilt, you know, and he hopes to get about 6 gallons, so we'll invite you up, maybe, and...
Do that. Yes, I'm not sure I'm going to drink any, but I'd love to come visit.
Chair, Representative Clark.
There's a quick question about the apples, too. I was looking at the booklet here, and Frostbite still has a TM on it, I see, and Sweet Tango has a registered mark, and so does, just there. But Honeycrisp doesn't anymore. Can you tell me
The patent for Honeycrisp ran out as of November of 2008. So the university no longer gets money from Honeycrisp.
And the others are
significantly smaller.
They're producing some funding for the program?
They are producing a fairly small amount of money for the program. And Honeycrisp in its heyday, when it was bringing in quite a bit of patent money, even to the research project it was bringing money into, it still didn't pay enough money to pay the full salary of the research scientist that was working with the fruit breeder.
So when you say a small amount, what is that? Can you give me a ballpark?
No, I really don't know.
Okay, if I could get there another time, it would be interesting. Okay, thank you.
Okay, and all of the patented things come back to the...
There's a shared formula so that you know, the university gets a certain percentage, and then the experiment station gets a percentage, and then the project gets a certain percentage. But I don't know what those percentages are.
All righty, thank you. Any other questions of Ms. Hoover? If not, then welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. Chair Rosalina and members of the committee, I'm Nancy Carpenter, and I am not from Duluth. And I am not from Crookston, but I am also not from the Twin Cities. I am from the Morris campus, and I'm very pleased to have this opportunity to speak with you today. It was very nice and fun and interesting to listen to the legislative advocates from the Twin Cities campus, because my opening line is that I've been working with young people at the Morris campus for 20 years, and it's people like this that make me think I have one of the best jobs that you can possibly have. I teach and do research in the area of organic chemistry. Lots of people have little alarm bells go off in their heads when they hear that. But this is a subject that is central to solving problems in the area of renewable energy, global climate change, medicine, just to name a few. Your doctor, your dentist, your pharmacist, and the people who make those pharmaceutical agents may very well have been taught by me or one of my colleagues. You want to make sure, as you're sitting on the operating table and they're about to carve into you, that they had a really outstanding education. And they're getting that. The young people we work with, in my opinion, are Minnesota's most precious resource, Honeycrisp apples notwithstanding, and they are our future. My daily commitment centers on my students' success in class, in their careers, and in life. To that end, I can give you a sampling of what I do. This past weekend, I participated in a retreat to help students of color succeed in science fields and help develop their leadership skills. I spend lots of one-on-one time with my students and advisees. Do you remember what you were like when you were 18 years old? Helping them get on a concrete path to a compatible career. I work one-on-one with my research assistants so they can develop into independent problem solvers. For example, we are currently collaborating with scientists at the USDA Agricultural Research Service in Morris on new oil seed crops that have the potential for use as sources of biodiesel. I help conduct intense mock interviews with students who are vying for prestigious national scholarships, and in all my spare time, I lecture and grade and assess and create and discuss and profess. This is what we do at Morris. We work with our students in classes and choirs, in studios and laboratories, in committees and lunchrooms. It's all about the FaceTime, just like these young people are saying. It's about being there with your students. It's a relationship that begins for me from beginning with visiting with prospective students and helping them find the right campus, the right fit for their college education, to staying in touch with alumni over many years. One of my colleagues is currently teaching his first students' grandchildren. It's a long-term relationship. We are tirelessly committed to our jobs and these students, and we have grave concern about our ability to maintain this kind of commitment, the commitment these students deserve, in the face of unallotments and budget cuts. We run on a lean budget and are astonishingly efficient with our resources. We volunteer a lot of our time, including over summer break, to do research and curriculum development salary-free. We graduate amazing young people who are prepared to do great things, but it takes people, time, and investment. And I would just echo what Representative Reinert said, it's all about priorities. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Any questions of Professor Carpenter? Well, you say hello to my good friend Tim Ray for me when you see him.
Oh,
okay? All righty. Go ahead.
My name is Caroline Hayes, and I'm a professor of mechanical engineering on the Twin Cities campus. And I wanted to just give you a little bit of a picture, literally, which is why I brought slides, because it's hard to really convey what we do in engineering without showing you what we do in engineering. So first, just a little bit about myself. So the mechanical engineering department is in the Institute of Technology at Minnesota, which houses both engineering and science. I happen to be the parent of a 10-year-old. And I have deep Minnesota roots as well. My great-great-grandfather surveyed and founded Fergus Falls, Minnesota. So with those connections to the past in Minnesota, I'm really proud to be at the University of Minnesota, where I can be a part of the future of Minnesota as well. So I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the relationships between the Institute of Technology and the economy of Minnesota. So we supply two main things, graduates to fuel to work in that high-tech workforce that's so important to the state, and then also cutting-edge research which fuels economic development in companies. And in fact, over 4,000 active companies have been founded by our alumni, with 55, you know, over 500,000 employees and $46 billion in revenue. So you recognize, of course, many of these companies, such as Control Data Corp, Donaldson, NPS Systems, Medtronic, and there's many, many more. So as of last year, we graduated over 1,000 bachelor's graduates in science and engineering. So that was the class of 2008, and that's the largest class we've ever had. And demand is only increasing with the economic downturn because people come back to retrain. Now they want to train in what they always wanted to do, but didn't really have the time to do before. And we are currently supplying between Twin Cities and Duluth, we're supplying 83% of the engineering graduates that are graduated in the state of Minnesota. So we supply a huge section of that high-tech workforce. So a little bit about what do we do in an engineering education. So some of the special things about engineering education is it's extremely hands-on. I mean, there's plenty of time spent in the classroom as well, you know, and reading textbooks is important too, but it's really important to do hands-on stuff. So some of the pictures I show the students doing here, like we have Deepa in the middle and David on the far side are both undergraduates working in research laboratories through the RU program, the Research Experiences for Undergraduates program. And then on the bottom, the guys in yellow running after the little car, that's our solar car, which is entirely designed and built by undergraduate students. And they enter it in competitions, and while they don't win every year, they win quite a bit. So those are just some of the things that they do, and you can't really get that kind of experience out of a textbook. You need the textbook, you have to get in there and you have to do it, you have to make your mistakes, and then you have to have your successes too in order to really learn engineering in a quality way. Here's an example of one of my projects that I'm doing right now. This is Mike Brickley. He happens to be a paraplegic and an alum of the University of Minnesota. He graduated in 2004, and he's come back to work with us and our students. And the students are building for him a robotic arm that's mounted on his wheelchair. He has a small amount of motion left in his right hand to control a joystick, but basically he can't do a lot in terms of caring for himself, but just picking up objects like your cell phone or your laptop or books off the shelf that we just normally take for granted. So they are developing a robot arm that can mount on his chair and enable him to live much more independently than he does now. So they're doing, each year they do some improvements, and this year, you note this is metal in this picture. They're going to be working on much lighter weight plastic and composite arm so that he can get a lot more power out of it. The boaters don't spend all their effort lifting the arms. They can spend it lifting the stuff he really wants to lift. And this is very time-intensive work. I mean, I spend a lot of time in the lab with the students coaching them on this. And I wanted to mention a new program under development that's going, it's a new type of distance education that you probably haven't heard of yet, in which we do what we call global engineering. So small teams in Minnesota will work with small teams in other states and other countries in order to jointly work on projects like this. Each will do a piece, but they need to collaborate to do it together. And that's important because that's how engineering is done these days. People don't sit in a room with all their teammates anymore out in industry. They are working, people in Minnesota may be working with people in Ireland to jointly develop, say, the next implantable heart product. And that's just how business is done. And that's how we need to start teaching our students to work. And so that's under development now. Now, in terms of the impact of funding cuts, what are some of the things that are going to happen? Well, already we have a pause on hiring of new faculty. So the faculty, as retirements happen and as attrition happens, we don't replace them, and that's probably going to continue, which means that we're getting larger. We're going to have to run larger class sizes. We're going to have less time to work hands-on with the students in those small groups. And they need those small groups. They need that hands-on work, as they have attested. And there's in turn less time for new program development, less time for research, less time for getting research funding, and less time for community outreach. One of the things I think is really important is the time we spend also away from the University of Minnesota, for example, in the K-12 schools, doing things like, in the picture you can see Marie Jeannie's robot dog. She's one of our faculty members. She's brought it to the school where the kids are interacting with the dog, the little girl's petting it. And through this, they get to understand what engineering is about. This is how we inspire that next generation. If nobody wants to be an engineer or think it's cool to be an engineer, they're not going to take that as their career goal. But it is fun. We're letting them know it's fun and rewarding, and that we are the type of doctors as well that make a difference in engineering. You've all probably heard the old joke about PhDs are doctors too, but not the kind that help people. Well, we do help people. We are the kind of PhD that helps people. So we want to continue being able to inspire the future generations and contribute to the future of Minnesota. And I personally invite all of you to come over and see directly for yourself, hands-on, what we do over at Minnesota. And so here's my contact info. Feel free to come over. And I've included a picture where some of your colleagues have come over just to inspire you to do the same. You can't let them come over without you coming over yourself. So hope to see you there soon. Thank you.
I figured you were going to ask the first question, who her grandfather, her great-grandfather was.
It's not a question, just to point out that I live in Fergus Falls.
Right.
So I've seen that statue thousands of times.
With the buckskin.
Yes. And I say there's no real family resemblance there.
Thanks, I think. I did used to have a jacket like that.
Oh, okay. All right. So I believe the Wright family also was instrumental in starting Otter Tail Power Company.
Yes. Yeah.
That's it?
No, okay.
Thank you for being here.
Ms. Hay, do you have to turn away students who want to become a mechanical engineer?
I don't believe we're turning them away. We realize how important they are, and we want to serve them. Before I say that, let me check with my department to see whether they've turned any away, but we are encouraging people in general to come. We want them to become engineers.
Representative Mahoney.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I suspect they turned them away, but not for more for grades than for anything else.
Right, thank you.
Well, you understood my question.
Right.
My question is, you're graduating 1,000 engineers a year. I would say that's not enough, but does that include the five campus system, or is that just the Twin City campus?
That number of 1,000, that's scientists and engineers, and that's the Twin City campus. So that's specifically what's coming out of IT. So the total for engineers at the Minnesota Twin Cities campus is 738, and then the total at Duluth as of last year was 129.
Mr. Chair, are they expanding the engineering divisions throughout the system?
I believe in with Duluth is, I don't know. And then, of course, members. The Range University of North.
Trying to get her a softball here, Ruth Davina. Will you give me a break?
Go ahead, Ms.
So, our Dean Kraut, has a plan in place to expand engineering. Because we feel, as you do, we are not graduating enough engineers to meet the needs in the state. The needs are growing much faster than we've been able to produce them. And I think it's critical that we be able to produce more in order to meet those needs. However, that expansion has not happened yet. It's planned. And this is one of the programs that I'm seriously concerned about not happening with the budget cuts. As I mentioned before, we already have this hiring pause, and it's very hard to have an expansion when you're not hiring anybody.
One last question of Ms. Hayes, and then we'll get on with Martin over there. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just out of curiosity, how many graduate students are there in the school of engineering at university?
How many graduate schools are there in the school?
How many students?
How many graduate students or students total?
Graduate students.
Mm-hmm.
In PhD program students.
Okay, in the PhD program last year, we graduated. So that's just in the top class that's coming out, not the whole student body. There were 131 PhDs. In terms of masters, there were 360 engineering students with master's degrees.
How many of those students were from Minnesota?
That data I do not have, but I can get for you.
That would be interesting to find out. How many are from Minnesota, how many from the United States, and so forth.
If you can get that information.
Yeah, I can get that information for you.
You can share that with the committee. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's fine. First, I want to compliment you on your work in the area of STEM, and I, too, share the concerns I heard Representative Mahoney about not being able to grow in an area we know we need and that we've put a lot of focus on in the K-12 system and we need to continue to focus on. So thank you for that. I wanted to also compliment you on the solar car. One of my constituents' children participated in that and has raved about it for years and would like more time, energy, and money put into that because it's been such a wonderful experience. So I'd share that. And then the question I had was with the use of, the students brought this up, the use of the 25% mandate for online learning and how that might fit in the type of programming that you have, whether you see in your department that 25% being a possibility or as you mentioned in your overhead slide, how important hands-on education and faculty-student contact is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so that's, I see, as a multi-part question. So first addressing the distance learning. Distance learning is something that we're already using to a large extent. I use it in most of my classes. Not all. It depends on the nature of the topic and whether you can. So the design team I showed you obviously doesn't work as well through that mode. But others I do offer in a joint online classroom. So I have some classroom students and then I have some who are online at the same time. I find that students choose to come to class if they can rather than do the online because it's a richer experience, they tell me. However, I do think online is extremely important for access, particularly to non-traditional students. A lot of our full-time working students who can't get the time off to come in and take the class on campus will do it that way. And they're often more mature students who have the skills to be able to handle that less structured type of environment. That said, distance education, as we've found it, is not necessarily any cheaper. I think it's essential. I think it's an important addition to access, an important additional option, but I don't see it as a way to control costs.
Thank you for that point, because I tend to agree with you. Mr. Sampson, awesome. You're going to tell us now how important political science is.
Yes, and I hope to make some larger points about the
Representative Bryan, did you have a question for Ms. Mahoney?
Just a very quick comment, Mr. Chair. I couldn't, after Representative Norton mentioned the solar car program again, I don't think I could return to Mankato if I didn't mention that Minnesota State Mankato also has a very strong solar car program and has for a number of years. So just to mention that. But the other comment is my daughter, my middle daughter, is one of those 1,000 graduates from your IT program last year. She graduated in geology and geophysics and is now a graduate student at Stanford. And I would say that while she's a very smart girl and could succeed in her own right, the university really gave her opportunities that she would have never had in terms of her exposure to a range of programs and challenges to her own innate abilities, and I'm grateful for what you do in your program. So I appreciate your work.
Mr. Sampson. Chairman Rukavina, members of the committee, my name is Martin Sampson. I, along with Caroline, are the two faculty liaisons from the University of Minnesota to the legislature, so you see us sitting in the chairs here frequently during your sessions. I'm in the political science department on the Twin Cities campus. Currently, at 8 o'clock Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings, I teach a course, an intro course on U.S. foreign policy. There are 55 students. The four books required for the course are available from Amazon.com for $56.50. They're different from the books that I used the last time I taught the course in fall 2007. Is this distance learning? Well, no, it's not, because it's a classroom, and the class happens at 8 in the morning. But the course relies very heavily on computers, and the course relies very heavily on the University of Minnesota's electronic subscriptions to journals. We don't have Xerox packets anymore. Students don't have to buy six books instead of four. Instead, people access online for free the most recent publications in scholarly journals or journals that are serious inquiries into various topics of pertaining to foreign policy. The end of the syllabus announces that the last week, 60 pages will be assigned that haven't been published yet. We'll wait and see what appears, and then I will choose the best of them. It's a vigorous use of computers. It saves the students money because all of this is free, and they get information that is a year at least ahead of the textbooks that would come out. I want to make a comment about my own department, and I apologize that it involves blowing, tooting our horn a bit, but then another shoe falls to rectify that. And the reason I want to make this comment is that it's an illustration of something that is, I think, broadly typical of the university. Details of the department, we have about 30 faculty. We have something like 665 students have identified themselves to us as political science majors. We graduated 227 undergraduates in the past year. The past 2 years, we've had some very, very good fortune. An undergraduate won the prestigious Truman Award. He also got to the very last part of the process for winning a Rhodes Fellowship. He was not successful in winning a Rhodes Scholarship, which is the most prestigious award that's available for an American undergraduate. But earlier in this decade, two other students, in fact, had succeeded. So we've had two winners of Rhodes Scholarship. We had a graduate student in the past year that won a national award for an outstanding PhD thesis. Last year, a colleague won an award for undergraduate teaching. Another colleague won an award for graduate teaching. Another colleague was one of only four political science people in the United States who won a Guggenheim Fellowship. Another colleague was admitted to the National Academy of Arts and Sciences, which is the absolute highest honor for an academic in the social sciences or the humanities. The department now has two such people. And then there were two people that wrote books that won national awards. Where's the other shoe? Well, here comes the other shoe. We're involved in a war. We're involved in a war to hold on to our faculty. And the war primarily is with private research universities, but it also involves some public research universities. In the past 2 years, private research university Northwestern has stolen two of our most prominent and most distinguished faculty. A year earlier, they hired away one of our very talented young faculty. So Northwestern has netted three of our faculty in the past 3 years. Past 2 years, Georgetown hired away another young faculty member who I think in the department had the highest undergraduate teaching rating currently. University of Michigan hired away somebody else. University of North Carolina hired away somebody else. And just recently, Rice University, private research university, has hired away another person. So we've had seven faculty that have left in the past 3 years, five to private research universities, to the public research university. And we now have 7 open positions in the department. It's very important to underscore that in each of these cases, there were non-monetary reasons why people thought about leaving and decided to leave. But it's also fair to note that every one of these people has gone to a university whose average salary is higher than the average salaries at the University of Minnesota. There is some good news. Last summer, Yale tried to steal one of our stars, and the university successfully countered that offer, so the person is still here. This fall, because of things being countered, 3 colleagues have declined interviews at North Carolina, at Georgetown, and at Berkeley. This kind of problem is a good sign. If you don't excel, you don't have these problems. So it's a good sign. But it's very, very important that we be able to win these very frequently. And one of the worries we have had for a number of years is that the deeper pockets of private research universities could slowly buy away the best of the researchers and the people bringing in the largest research grants at public research universities, such as the University of Minnesota. Second point, it pertains to a global context. In 2004, The Economist, the British weekly magazine, ran an article about higher education in Britain and in Europe that had the following passage. It says, quote, "No wonder that British and European academics cast envious and wondering eyes at the American university system." And what they mean here is the entire gamut, from 2-year community colleges to research universities. It manages both quantity and quality. More than 60% of American high school graduates at least start some form of tertiary education. And it keeps standards high as well. End quote. Why was The Economist publishing that article? Well, Shanghai University in China had just released the first of what became annual rankings of 500 universities in the world. And when China does that, academia's eyebrows rise and people listen. The reaction in Europe was shock. It turned out that 35 of the top 50 universities on Shanghai's rating were in the United States. The 2008 version of this study, unless I miscounted, has 36 of the top 50 universities in the world also in the United States. And for the West Europeans and for the British, that was not good news. Part of the message here is that U.S. higher education continues to be regarded as the world standard. This is not one of those areas where a Toyota has passed a General Motors or passed a Ford. When you go to the Shanghai rankings in the U of M, in 2003, the U of M ranked 37th. 2008, the University of Minnesota has risen to 28th among the top 500. What does this study measure? Well, it measures public research, it measures awards won, accomplishments of alums who are products of graduate programs who publish various kinds of research. It's hardly a fair or a sufficiently broad assessment of all of the things that matter at the University of Minnesota. It's oblivious to teaching, it's oblivious to service, and for that reason, I think there's some reason to take it with a grain of salt. On the other hand, in a century in which the two major powers may well be the U.S. and China, it's deeply important that the University of Minnesota continue to impress the Chinese. And if this is how they're ranking universities, we want to register on that. And of course, the corollary is, it's deeply important that the University of Minnesota continue to earn that ranking through research that brings hundreds of millions of dollars each year into the economy of Minnesota. Let me skip the rest of what I was going to say and just jump to the conclusion, which is one of concern. It seems to me that the challenges of the next few years, as far as the University of Minnesota is concerned, are going to require very, very careful navigation. The University of Minnesota is a very complicated place. It has a very complicated mission. And there is going to have to be very careful, very well-informed navigation through these waters that we will confront in the next couple of years. It seems to me it's crucial that Minnesota emerge a few years hence from this very difficult era with a public research university that continues to impress the Chinese, that continues to contribute significantly to the state's economy, and that offers outstanding educational opportunities to Minnesotans in many fields of study. Thank you.
Okay, questions? Representative Fulcombe.
Mr. Chair, I have a question about the percentage of time spent, and this is for anyone and everyone, percentage of time spent on research and the percentage of time spent on face-to-face teaching in your particular job. Second part of the question, you mentioned a class size of 55. What would you say is the average undergraduate class size that you teach?
Chair Rupavina, Representative Slocum, I'm sure somebody has a figure of what an average class size is in the College of Arts or the university. My teaching happens to be in areas of foreign policy, Middle East politics, and U.S. foreign policy. And there are certain courses that skyrocketed in the past few years that previously had much lower enrollment. And my stance in regard to that has been to object to anybody putting a limit on it, because it seems to me if the country's at war in a given part of the world and there are people who are heading for Iraq or they're coming back from Iraq, they want an opportunity to study that part of the world, that the least we can do is make sure that the doors are open. In general, the international relations courses I have taught at the University of Minnesota over 30 years have tended to have fairly sizable enrollments. We have freshman seminars that are limited to 20. Early in my career in the 1980s, I remember teaching an international oral politics course that had 200, which is not ideal.
And the research question doesn't apply to you so much, or does it?
Well, it does. I may be an outlier, because I've always tilted a bit more in the direction of teaching than research. This semester, I'm working on a paper that will be presented at a conference. That's sort of the third layer of my activities this semester. There's constant updating of courses, because the material that I'm teaching is in motion also. The subject is in motion. And I put a great deal of time into teaching.
The other three professors want to comment on class or student contact versus research?
Sure, Mr. Chair, thank you. I would have to answer the question by saying I consider my research, in which I work with undergraduate students, as teaching as well. In the summer, we at the Morris campus are pretty much 100% doing research there. I don't do summer classes. With regard to class size, I've taught as large a class as 113 in organic chemistry. When you consider that the total student population at the Morris campus is about 1,600, that's a fairly large class. We've worked very hard to break the classes in the sections so that we have smaller class sizes, and now they're typically, for my class, they're typically more like, 35 to 50.
Ms. Huber, you want something?
Let's see. I've taught classes in general biology that had 450. But that also breaks them down into lab sections on a weekly basis to lab sections of 24. I don't teach general biology anymore. I teach a class that fulfills a biology with lab requirement at the university at the 1,000 level that has 120 students. And I usually teach two of those lab sections, so I get 60 of them in lab, and 60 of them have a teaching assistant. Our freshman seminars are capped at 20, as Martin said. Our graduate seminars vary anywhere from 5 to 12 students, probably. So it really depends on the level of students. I think that what we've done at the undergraduate level at the university, and Martin and I have been on a number of undergraduate initiatives together, is that we know that we need to, some of our classes are going to have fairly large lectures, but we've worked very hard at making sure we break them down into smaller recitation or laboratory sections so students have an individual they know they can go to in order to help them with their study issues.
And Ms. Hayes.
Uh-huh. And our college works pretty much the same way as Emily's in that respect. So I've taught classes that range from 150 to as small as 7, depending on the type of class that it is. And again, we for the big classes, we try very hard to break them into the smaller sections. I also would say that in terms of the division between teaching and research, they're very difficult to
separate, as I think I showed in my, you know, my earlier talk. I mean, so for example, the undergraduate student team that was building the robot arm was also doing so on the advice and guidance from both myself and a graduate student doing research on robotics. And then during the summer, the education of the graduate students continues to go on through research. So the research and the graduate mission, graduate education mission, as well as the undergraduate mission, are tightly tied. Much of the REU program, the research experiences for undergraduates, also occurs during the summer where we have them in the research lab. So I'm not sure how you separate research and education. Research is education, and education is something we also research.
Okay, members, we're a little over. Meeting adjourned. We have Minskew on Thursday. And I believe either Mr. Olson from the Board of Trustees or Mr. Benson or someone will be here. Thank you.